We usually explore the science of climate change. Today, it's art about the warming climate from a poet whose country is being irrevocably changed. Kathy Jetnell Kijener is an educator and an activist from the Marshall Islands, and her first book of poetry is due to be released early next year. She's in the Twin Cities for the 10th anniversary of the Will Steger Foundation. Joins me in the studio. Welcome. It's really good to have you here.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
What do you think poetry can say about climate change that science and statistics can't?
Well, I think science and statistics, of course, is, so valuable and so important. But the good thing about poetry is that it brings the humanity to the, humanity to the topic, basically. It connects people to the issues. Because I think science and statistics can sometimes distance people from the topics, and it can kind of make people feel separate and cold and even a little bit depressed, honestly. And I think poetry brings us, it moves us, and it reminds us why these kinds of issues are important and why we need to be fighting for our warming planet. Yeah.
You know, this is what I've always thought about fiction, that it can tell a truth in some ways that nonfiction and journalism can't.
Yes,
right?
Definitely.
That
I think
we're more
it touches
to
us,
it? Yeah.
You know, and I think being touched and being moved can be just so much more effective than just knowing the issue, just understanding the, you know, the issue, the topic.
Tell me about your background and your experience on the Marshall Islands.
So I was born in the Marshall Islands, and me and my family moved to Hawaii. So in Hawaii, that's where I grew up. And then I went to college in California.
Okay.
And then after that, I returned back home to the Marshall Islands.
And so I was going to say, so you saw the Marshall Islands in, how old are you? And you were in your mid-30s?
I think I was like, no, I was my 20, like 21 right, around that time, 20 around that time when I
just
returned
wanted
back home.
I wanted to ask you about the changes geographically that you've seen in the Marshall Islands then over the course of several decades.
Well, I think it's not so much the changes that I witnessed. It was more that I witnessed my first inundation, my first flooding while I was out in the Marshall Islands. So the Marshall Islands, you have to remember, is only 2 meters above sea level, completely flat, no mountains.
Which is about 6.5 feet, right?
Yeah. And it's completely flat. And the ocean looks huge out there. So you don't realize it, how vulnerable the country is, until you're actually there and seeing it. Because in some places, it's so thin, you can see ocean on either side of you.
Wow.
And so my first inundation is basically because of the rising sea level, the water floods whenever we have a high tide onto the island, and then it destroys homes, destroys crops. And I witnessed my first inundation after I returned home. And that's when I started to realize, whoa, this is serious. And that's when I began to really look into climate change and began to start writing about climate change, as I always do with anything that I, you know, I'm trying to understand. I always turn to my poetry.
Are these inundations, are they happening when there are big storms? Something unusual going on weather-wise, or this has just become...
Not always. Yeah, it's become, like, it was interesting. I was talking to the meteorologist in the Marshall Islands. His name's Reggie. And I asked Reggie, what is it about this that's different? And he said that every time now, you know, before, if there was a high tide, it was no big deal. It was just another high tide.
Right.
But now, every single time there's a high tide, we're on alert that there could be a flooding. Every single time. That's not common. That it never used to be like that at all. And I've talked to the elders, you know, my mother. I've talked to people around me and I've asked them, have you seen this many flooding like this before? And each of them have said, never. They've never witnessed anything like this before.
So these are people, some of whom are living right at the coast. Although I realize that
all of us live on the coast.
You're basically all on the Marshall Island is the main island. How large is it?
I don't know the square footage or whatever, but I do know that it's an hour to drive from one end to another. It's very thin, basically.
This is why you say you're basically on the coast.
Yeah, everybody's on. So it's not like, hey, why don't you guys move inland?
That's what I was going to ask you.
No, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to go, basically. Yeah.
So what does that mean as you say, for people who make their livelihood raising crops or...
Mm-hmm. Well, these days people are living off of, a lot of people live off of the breadfruit, the pandanus, but we also are, living off of imported food too from America, So a lot of people are turning to more imported foods, because it's always going to be there. You can just buy it from the store and you don't have to worry about it getting destroyed, which becomes another issue in and of itself, right? Because then you're relying too much on imported food, which is all bad for you. It's all canned food, basically, mm-hmm. that we're eating. And we already have some of the highest diabetes rates in the Pacific.
Wow.
Yeah, so these are, that's an interesting issue that I've actually never explored. So just
the
now.
Intersection
yeah,
of
the intersection of health, you know, and health. And I have talked about that, but that's an interesting point, is how it affects our diet. Yeah.
Yeah, people have already left, haven't they?
Not some to come people, back? Some people, like, you know, the thing is, like, migration happens in the Marshalls the same way migration happens anywhere. You know, people leave because opportunities, school, family, whatever. There's only a few people, like, I've only known of, like, maybe one or two families that have left because of climate change. Everyone else is, you know, staying because it's, that's their home.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What about making that decision, though? I mean, that it's not that far off that some of that land that people are living on now will be uninhabitable, right?
It isn't. Actually, I need to explain something. We're an atoll, right? So there's
right.
little islands nearby us that you could just kind of take a little motorboat to, maybe mm-hmm. like 20 minutes, 15 minutes. There's a little island that actually I heard went underwater. So I went and investigated with my cousin, and we saw it. And I met with the man who lived there his whole life, and I asked him, you know, what happened to this island? It was right nearby his island. And he said, you know, that island used to be lush. It used to have coconut trees, breadfruit trees, crabs, everything. And now it's just a pile of sand and rocks. That's all it looks like. It doesn't even look like an island. It looks like a sandbar. And he said, no, that was an island 10 years ago, and now it's gone. Now it looks like what the rest of the Marshall Islands would look like, basically, if the inundations keep happening. I read from...
Which they will, won't they?
Exactly, they will. And I heard from a friend who is a marine biologist. He said, it's not that the island will go under. It's that so much flooding will continue to occur that it's going to become unlivable. And that's the issue.
Because it washes away the topsoil.
Yeah, exactly.
Because of
yeah.
what happens with all that ocean water coming
because
up
on the
land.
Because you're going to have to just keep rebuilding. Because you're going to have to keep being, you know, creating new material. Because it's going to, you know, destroy all the crops. All of that, yeah.
So you have a child.
Yes. I do. She's 2 years old.
And is your idea that she will be able to live on the Marshall Islands, and then you look at how quickly this climate change is happening and the consequences of that, you must wonder about that.
I do. I wonder what she's going to come up and, you know, what she's going to know. I wonder, how is she going to be connected to the land? I wonder, you know, will she be fighting too in her generation? Will she not have to fight at all? I mean, I'm pretty sure she's going to have to fight, but, you know, you don't want to put anything, I don't want to make her become a climate activist.
But I mean, when you yeah. say fight, Kathy, what
yeah.
does that mean?
I
mean,
I guess,
this is inexorable. You can't really,
yeah.
even making changes today probably is not going to stop what's happening on the Marshall Islands, is it?
Well, I think so. I mean, I have a firm belief that, you know, if that there's still a chance to turn things around, that there's still time to do the changes necessary so that, you know, most of our, you know, our islands can still continue to be livable. You know, I think we still have the opportunity to do so. And so when I say fight, I mean speak out, represent, you know, make sure that people hear us in the Marshall Islands, that, you know, there is an island out here trying to survive, and that this is what's at stake. So it's kind of, that's what I mean when I say fight, yeah.
You're listening to the Climate Cast, and I'm having a conversation with Kathy Jetnil Kijener. She's an educator, an activist, and a poet from the Marshall Islands, and we're talking about the geography there, how they're seeing changes from climate change in real time, and the writing and the art that comes from her experience there. So you wrote a poem that you read at a big climate summit
mm-hmm.
in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
I've asked if you'll read a couple of stanzas from it, but give me a little bit of background on the poem.
Well, so the poem is called Dear Mate Filipinum. My daughter's full name is Mate Filipinum Kathy Macarusa.
Uh-huh. It's beautiful. It has a lot of rhythm and music to it.
Yeah. So my partner is Samoan and I'm Marshallese. And so Mate Fele is his village and uh-huh. also his grandmother. Binum is the land that my family comes from. So I wanted to make sure that both our names are in that piece to kind of hearken to our connection to the land. So basically what happened was I got selected to be the civil society speaker at the UN Climate Summit in 2014. And they originally were planning on creating, like, showing some videos, some images, and having Leonardo DiCaprio read over those images. But once they realized that I was spoken word artist, they were like, why don't you just write, can you just write a new poem for us? And you have to remember, this was within like 2 weeks away. You know, they wanted me to write a poem to save the world. They literally said that
at one point.
And to
Kathy.
Speak to the climate movement and to the world
no
leaders.
No pressure. No pressure
yeah,
at all.
Exactly. And, you know, I I was teaching for the first time, 4 classes, 80 students. I was breastfeeding at night. I know, sorry, TMI. But, you know, either way, it was hard. But so this poem came out because I said, I don't know anything about the climate movement. I don't know anything about how to speak to islanders, but I mean, to leaders. But I just, you know, I just had this baby. She was 7 months old at the time. I was like, maybe I could speak to her. You know, I could tell her about what we're trying to do for her generation, for the world. And, you know, just something, you know, and you don't, the thing is, it turned out to be hopeful because you don't want to yell at your kid. You don't want to tell them that doom and gloom to your kid. You want to tell them that there's hope, that there's a chance out there. So that's where this poem came from, basically. Yeah.
So a couple stanzas, if you would.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
I'll just start from the middle.
All right.
And even though there are those hidden behind platinum titles who like to pretend that we don't exist, who like to pretend that the Marshall Islands, Tuvalu, Kiribati, Maldives, Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, and all the floods of Algeria, Colombia, Pakistan, and all the earthquakes, hurricanes, and tidal waves didn't exist? Still, there are those who see us. Hands reaching out, fists raising up, banners unfurling, megaphones booming, and we are canoes blocking coal ships. We are the radiance of solar villages. We are the fresh, clean soil of the farmer's past. We are petitions blooming from teenage fingertips. We are families biking, recycling, reusing, engineers dreaming, designing, building, artists painting, dancing, writing, and we are spreading the word.
Kathy, thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So, Paul, the art and the science of climate change. She's really interesting. Her mother is the president. I can't remember if we actually talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what we were saying off air was that although there has been a lot of reporting about people having to leave the Marshall Islands as climate refugees, she says that there's a couple people that have left.
Right.
But that is something that the country really has to confront for the next 25 or 30 years.
Yeah, and it's the Marshall Islands in the same situation as several other places, the U.S. Gulf Coast, Louisiana. There are people there that are, in fact, relocating already as well as some of that land gets swallowed up. So we're just on the front edge of that, Carrie. I think we're going to see that trend accelerate in the next 30 to 50 years.
One of the things that you and I have been watching is what's happening in the Arctic. And I just checked a statistic with you on how much higher the average temperature has been in the Arctic this year.
It's crazy. It's off the charts, something that scientists haven't seen before, as much as 20 to 30 plus degrees, even 36 degrees warmer than average in the Arctic. And this has been persistent, Carrie. It's been going on for really several months now. The results of that are that Arctic sea ice is at record lows for this time of year. In fact, they've had nights. Well, of course, it is always night now up in the Arctic Ocean,
right,
where we've been melting ice in November in the Arctic. So that is,
so it's warm enough overnight that the ice continues to melt.
Correct.
Overnight.
And so that is way off the charts for this time of year. So what I like to say is what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. It's not like Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And so because it's been so warm up there, that's one of the reasons we've been so warm this fall in Minnesota, why we had the second warmest November on record. Anytime we get a cold front coming from the north, it just doesn't have the punch. Changes on the way, though. There's bitterly cold air in Siberia. That's working into Alaska, and some of that air will get here next week. So hang in there, winter lovers. And by the way, happy meteorological winter today.
Yeah, today. Hey, since you mentioned Alaska, Paul, I'm looking at a New York Times story on this. The area of missing ice is the size of Alaska and Texas put together. That's some territory there.
It is a lot of territory. And so the question becomes, as those trends continue, how does that warmer Arctic affect the weather where we live in the mid-latitudes? And as we've talked with Jennifer Francis and others before, there are clearer links beginning to be established in those connections between the Arctic and our weather.
Hey, the other thing that I think we're trying to talk about, we're looking for a scientist for next week's climate cast, is how what's happening in the Arctic is affecting the food chain up there.
Fascinating stuff.
The production of algae and what the animals and the sea life feed on there.
More algae and in some cases an abundance and a change in where this sea life is being found. So, yeah, as things change, there are domino effects. And so it'll be interesting to see how that pans out. I'm looking forward to that discussion next
week. Paul, we'll see you next week on the ClimateCast.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carrie.